So the very startling and provocative proposition in Dzogchen that we are going to examine and experiment with is that in this immediate present moment of awareness, are all the bodies of a Buddha, or pristine awareness, all of this is accessible, or is there right there waiting to be discovered, but it is obscured in this present moment by our conceptualizing mind and taking that conceptualization that we project to be the real truth about reality of the world and ourselves and our relationship, the relationship of perception and the world. So we have to ask then, what is it that is obscuring it? And the answer in Dzogchen, it is our identification with being the body, speech, and mind of a sentient being, and taking that to be the whole truth and nothing but the truth. And that, so of course, there is a perspective from which that is true. There is a conventional reality. I am a sentient being. I have a body. There is a conventional perspective from which that's true. I, Doug, have this particular set of memories, which has been configured in relationship to my environment, my family history, all of that, which is different than yours. Put that my name on it, and you put my name on it, you put your name on it. There is a perspective from which that's true. But the identification with it is that we take that to be who I am, and that this is the truth of who I am. And in order to see through that truth, we have to, or you could say probably what empowers that delusion and keeps it alive is the identification with all of these appearances that are arising moment to moment in the mind as being the karmically produced, deluded experiences of mental affliction and dissatisfaction. A samsaric world that is produced by karma and klesha. So there is perspective from where that is true, but it is not the whole truth. And there is, in fact, in greater or a more encompassing view, which actually views that conceptualizing mind from a larger truth. And the way that we cut through to that perspective where we can see the full context, you could say, of the conceptualizing mind, not as the truth, but as a relative truth that is applies within a limited context, but the bigger context is a bigger picture, and that is the view from pristine awareness. So to transcend the limited view, we have to break the identification with that every appearance that arises to the mind in the present moment is actually who I am. It is an appearance in my mind, for instance, or that I am angry, or that I am sad, that, all of these identifications of who I am and being fused with our mental afflictions and even with our thoughts, regardless of whether they are happy or sad, but just our everyday musings. And the belief about the way that the world exists. The lake right there is out there. The trees are out there. The sky is out there. There is a very distinct boundary between in here, the perceiver, the subject with my name on it, and all of this world out there that I am just getting, unbiased sense data about. That's the way it seems. So we buy into that, and all of these appearances we take to be the whole truth. So the way that we actually, as a meditative path, cut through that and see the larger context, the space within which all of these appearances are arising, so that we can see a more encompassing truth, is with the practice that Dujom Lingpa in the text Essence of Clear Mind calls taking aspects of the mind as the path. So we have a number of different synonymous names for it. Taking the impure mind as the path, taking awareness and appearances as the path, settling the mind in its natural state. And then in this text, he calls it taking aspects of the mind as the path. And so that's what I'll be calling it this weekend, because we're really working with the framework that he presents of the four modes of mindfulness in this text. So the framework that the four modes of mindfulness is presented within is as a subhead of this practice of taking aspects of the mind as the path. So when we're actually doing this practice of taking aspects of the mind as the path, we are seeing through the identification with these appearances as being something real, concrete, solid, something other than what they are, which is really they have the essence of dream. And so and this is what our whole practice of the four modes of mindfulness is going to lead us to, is lucid dreaming in the waking state. But it might be a bit of a leap right now to jump into that practice. So there's a little bit more preparation. So by tomorrow, you'll be ready to jump into the practice. You'll have a lot of experience this afternoon with this what I think of as a bridge technique. And so there is the critical skill that is necessary for these four modes of mindfulness to make progress through them. And especially for the first one, which is single-pointed mindfulness, is that you first of all have to distinguish between stillness and motion. So that's the first task. Recognize the difference between the stillness of your awareness and the movement of mental appearances. And then you have a simultaneous experience of them, a unification of stillness and motion. And so this is, if we were to undertake that practice right away, you know, which is the way that Dujom Lingpa really presents it, it could be an experience basically of just everyday daydreaming. You know, of just sitting down out on a park bench and looking out over the lake and letting your thoughts ramble for an hour. And, you know, is that meditation practice? Or have we just been snared by the ruminating mind and gone off wandering for an hour, doing what Dujom Lingpa calls marmot meditation? And so in order to prepare ourselves well before we enter the arena with our mental appearances, because these mental appearances, one of the things that makes them so challenging to work with is that they often have an emotional charge and they're very compelling. So we are more inclined to be confused with and to go wandering with something that had an appearance that has a really powerful emotional charge, a memory or a fantasy, some thought about something that we are really anticipating or fearing. All of these have a strong charge that as soon as they arise, they take, you know, they grasp, well, actually it's awareness grasps onto them and then is set in motion. You go wandering with them, and it can be 10 minutes before you spontaneously disengage and realize this is not the breath any longer, or that my still awareness has been set in motion. So in order to prepare for that, wouldn't it be nice to have a practice where we can actually work on this standalone skill of recognizing the difference between stillness and motion, and then fusing stillness and motion with an object that is not so compelling, so alluring, so demanding as mental appearances? So the answer to that is found in what Alan calls the Dzogchen approach to mindfulness of breathing, and what I call just simply awareness of the breath. So I think they are the same thing, but mine is, awareness of the breath is just shorter. Maybe easier to remember. But the distinction also, I think, really helps to point out that this is awareness of the breath rather than attention focused on the breath. And this is really the essence of the practice, is preparing us to enter the four modes of mindfulness, but with the familiar object of the breath. And so this really is, I think, truly found in the spirit, or the spirit of this is found in the Buddha's minimalist advice on breath meditation that you find in both the Pali Canon and in the Kangyur. In the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra in 10,000 stanzas, it says, "Shariputra, take the analogy of a potter or a potter's apprentice spinning the potter's wheel. If he makes a long revolution, he knows it is long. If he makes a short revolution, he knows it is short. Shariputra, similarly, a bodhisattva, a great being, mindfully breathes in and mindfully breathes out. If the inhalation is long, he knows the inhalation is long. If the exhalation is long, he knows the exhalation is long." And then he goes on and on and on, you know, so, you know, all of the possible permutations, you know, inhalation short, exhalation short, etc. So this is in the four applications of mindfulness, this is called these four applications always begin with what the Buddha called clear comprehension. So you really have to see, first of all, what is actually there. So you have clear comprehension of the breath. And here, what is interesting is that the Buddha doesn't mention tactile sensations at all. It is simply the rhythm of the breath and this interesting verb, knowing. So you are knowing the rhythm of the breath, simply knowing whether the rhythm is long or short, whether this particular breath is long or short. So that is really the crucial advice for this practice. And I still remember the first time that I heard this, when Lama Alan first taught this in Phuket, was it? Or was that Araluen? So I remember it really well. I could remember my response really well. Anyway, did you hear it if the first time? So maybe, I think it was Phuket. No, it must, yeah, anyway, it doesn't matter. What was really radical about it, so he had just come back from personal retreat in Scotland after leading a retreat in a hermitage cave, and this came to him, he said. And he was so excited about it. And immediately when I heard this practice, I thought, this is the missing link between breath meditation and settling the mind in its natural state. And so here is really the practice. Engaging the breath, or it's a lot better to say knowing the breath, with awareness rather than attention. Awareness, one of the qualities of awareness is it can be aware of multiple things at once. So attention can only be aware of one thing. That is its job. You know, it is out of the myriad of possibilities. So awareness is the whole point. The way that awareness engages with reality is it getting a multitude of things in a single picture, so and creating a gestalt out of something that has a multitude of elements in it. And this open receptive awareness knows relationships between the things in the picture very well, and knows the full context of things, of the whole picture. And then the job of attention is to pluck one of the things out of all of the possibilities in this room right now to just examine it very closely. And so right now I see Jarrett pondering with his hands on his upper lip, you know, because he's got this beard now. He can be, you know, stroking his beard, you know, and thinking, you know, about this. So, now Terry has just stroked her hair, so there's movement in the room. So now my attention has just shifted. But I couldn't have been aware of Terry while my focus was on Jarrett if there wasn't some larger context in which attention was arising. Right? If Jarrett was the whole of my experience, I would never have noticed the movement of Terry's hand. So now my attention has been shifted to Terry, but now I look in the back and, you know, I see something else. Now I look all the way out to the lake. But all of you are still potential objects of attention because I am aware of you in peripheral awareness. So this is the peripheral awareness. Chuladasa describes it as being like peripheral vision. You know, and so just as your vision can focus on an individual object in this room right now, your peripheral vision is still aware of all of the other elements. And then when something is deemed significant, and there are processes, unconscious processes, for why your attention would shift to a particular object, then your attention shifts, but your awareness remains of the whole picture. And so the thing about attention is that it can only know, it can't know context. It can't know relationship between individual pieces. Only awareness can do that, because all attention knows is this single, abstracted, conceptually created element, which is artificial. As Ian McGilchrist calls it, dead, lifeless, mechanical. You know, so there's nothing real about it. It is an abstract fabrication. So all of these things that we pluck out of the big picture have lost their meaning because they have lost their context. You know, the whole picture. So things only have real meaning and life in the full context of their lived reality, you could say, in quotes. But the bigger picture of relationship of different elements. So anyway, this is the job of awareness to do that. And so because we're dealing with awareness now, not attention, we can actually have awareness can do multiple things at once. And so we can then, now our task is to be with 80% of our awareness, to be aware of the big picture, basically, which is the stillness and spaciousness of awareness. So this is the overarching context in which all of everything else is going to occur. So this is like being aware of everything in this room. So you are being aware of everything in your mind, basically, and the big picture of everything in your mind is stillness and spaciousness. Everything occurs within the stillness and spaciousness of your mind. And so it's not only the little things, the individual appearances that are capture your attention, but it is the context in which these are arising, which is what you are primarily aware of. And this is what you are primarily aware of. So 80%, because remember what we're doing is developing the standalone skill of the fusion of stillness and motion before we go to the mind with this simple object of the breath or the rhythm of the breath. And so what we are first wanted to come to know is stillness. So this is what we're going to give 80% of our awareness to. Simply knowing the stillness and spaciousness of awareness. This is the awareness that illuminates appearances but does not become them. It isn't set in motion by them, simply by becoming aware of an appearance, which is its illuminating power. So we are just aware of stillness and spaciousness with 80% of our awareness. And then the other 20% of our awareness, so you can think of these as, you know, just approximations. Or don't get hung up on the percentages. But let's just say the great preponderance of our awareness knows the stillness and spaciousness of awareness, and then the smaller part of awareness is still aware of this is what is arising. This is the motion that is arising within the stillness. So 20% of your awareness then knows the rhythm of the breath. So, and you can do these simultaneously. You know, it is one awareness that is aware of multiple things. And so, as the Buddha said, when you breathe in long, you have a clear comprehension. This is a long breath. When you breathe in short, you have a clear comprehension. This is a short breath. And that is all that you are doing. So in our practice, when we do this meditation, we're going to begin with Asanga's mindfulness of breathing, because that focuses on tactile sensations, or the object is tactile sensations. But then we're going to very quickly drop the tactile sensations. And so the knowing of the rhythm of the breath is just as the potter knows the rhythm or the revolution of his wheel is long or short. He knows it. He doesn't need a metronome to compare it to, or he doesn't need a stopwatch, or some calibrating device to tell him, this, your wheel is long, your wheel is short. It is a direct, immediate knowing, non-verbal, non-conceptual. It is just a knowing. And so this is the way that we are going to then know the breath. It is, you're going to know the breath as a mental experience rather than a tactile experience. And so this is the really unique thing about this practice, is that you know the breath immediately without tactile sensations. And, you know, there are a lot of footnotes about this, of, you know, when Alan first had this experience, he thought, could that really be possible to know the breath without, by immediate knowing without tactile sensations? And then, of course, the thought came to him about lucid dreaming, for instance, and how, and then that led to asking Stephen LaBerge, the expert at Stanford on lucid dreaming, and they both agreed, and it's been corroborated by those people who are able to know in deep dreamless sleep, even can know the rhythm of the breath, apparently. So you can easily have. So I mean, this is basically, I'm just saying that to quell your objections at the beginning that this is impossible, because I have heard that before. But you get an immediate experience of this. It's an easy thing to get in your meditation. So, and then you have no doubts about it at all once you get it. But it is, so the breath then becomes a mental experience rather than a tactile experience. And something interesting happens when it becomes a mental experience. So the Buddha said that know the breath is long, know the breath is short. And then after a time, you know, in doing your meditation practice, what usually happens, and not always, but the usual trajectory is that an agitated mind becomes more and more calm, becomes more and more still. You can just become really distracted and, you know, a memory comes up and then you get more agitated or something by memory or and become mentally afflicted or something. But, you know, generally the path is that you start off more agitated and with thoughts, especially when you've just had lunch, you know, or especially if you've just checked the web or you've just had conversation or something. You start off agitated and then your mind becomes more and more calm. So when you are paying attention then to long and short, when is your breath long and when is it short, meaning the rhythm of the breath? It's an interesting thing that really seems counterintuitive. And the reason it seems counterintuitive may be because of our what we've heard before. You know, so when I was first taught to meditate, you know, really, really working on real meditation years ago, my teacher told me to equalize the exhalation and inhalation. This is true in yoga there, and Theos Bernard cites this also, one of the early pioneers of yoga research, that in yoga traditions, the breath was usually linked with either 5 or 6 heartbeats. And so one of my early meditation teachers said, equalize the inhalation and exhalation, and then link that to, and the rhythm of it should be, and count the heartbeats in your eyelid, and then count inhalation 5 heartbeats, exhalation 5 heartbeats. So that really, you know, the implicit message in there is that stability and deep relaxation are all associated with this 5 heartbeats. That's a, you know, a long period of breath. You know, it's kind of what it is, its intent, what it is doing is it's slowing down your natural rhythm of breath, you know, basically. You know, so really deep, long breaths. And then, you know, our yoga teachers also do the same thing. When you're in a pose, you're developing, you know, inhale, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Exhale, 1, 2, right? You know, so the implicit message in that is that the more that this long period of breath is better, because it somehow leads to, you know, I guess the implicit message is tranquility, serenity, all of that with this long period of breath. But this is something that Alan first pointed out, and I was, you know, again, this sounds counterintuitive, but that what you notice actually is that when you become really, really, really finely balanced and your mind is just feels like it's on the knife edge of shamatha, you know, it's just so finely balanced that your breath becomes really rapid and shallow. And how rapid? Well, Alan's hypothesis, and we actually in some retreats have done research on this, you know, and it's difficult to do research on yourself while you're meditating, but that was the task. But you can really basically do this when you get into that state and just notice, is it long or short, and how short? About 15 cycles per second. For an inhalation every 2 seconds, exhalation every 2 seconds, so a full cycle of inhalation and exhalation every 4 seconds. That's really, you know, seems like just sitting here that would be almost like panting, but it's not. What it is, it's shallow. And your mind becomes more and more tranquil and your awareness becomes like a glassy, calm sea that is, in the metaphor, able to reflect even the stars. You know, can you imagine the ocean that was just so flat, calm, that you couldn't tell whether it was sky or ocean? You know, all the planets, all the stars reflected there. You look up, you look down, you know, vertigo. You don't know where you are. You're caught between, you know, it's like you're in deep space. So that's, you know, the glassy, calm ocean. No turbulence whatsoever. So as you become, your awareness begins to approach that, your breath really becomes short. The cycle really slows down, or speeds up, so that it becomes more rapid, but it becomes very, very shallow then. And you're no longer breathing with, you know, full, deep inhalations and exhalations. But there's just this little, you know, flutter, basically, because you're so calm that there's just not much oxygen required to metabolize mental afflictions or whatever. So this is the, you know, so a couple of interesting comparisons or corollaries there, or interesting elements there also. So all of you tantric yogis know how many breaths there are in a day, right? You know, this is found in the Guhya Samaja Tantra, in the early sections. They really go into the breath a great deal, and periods of when one nostril is, and how long, what part of the day you're breathing through the left nostril, what time and part of for how long you're breathing through the right nostril. And the total number of breaths per day is 21,600. And you do the math, and damn, that comes out to 15 cycles of breath per minute. Interesting. So weird. 21,600 short, shallow breaths. So Alan's, you know, in the, all of the, when you're talking about the progression through shamatha and then into the absorptions of the jhanas, you know, you reach a point in the fourth jhana where your breath stops altogether, right? And so you have Kevala Kumbhaka. And so no heart rate, no breath, perceptible anyway. And you can stay in that state for days at a time without dying. You know, this is how yogis show off in India, is they're buried underground for 7 days, you know, and they, you know, are exhumed and they brush themselves off and take a deep breath, you know, and what did I miss? But, you know, what they haven't, you know, it's not that they've died and been resurrected. They were just in this period of, you know, hibernation almost. They would be totally aware during that period, but just not breathing. So Alan's hypothesis, and this was always the thought returning to this period of, is the breath long or short? For years and years in the yoga training for, you know, these practices that I got in Tantra, when we were talking about the suspension of breath and Kevala Kumbhaka, it was, you know, this is just what I understood. I don't know if this was the intention or not, but I think so, was that as you progress, basically what happens is that the suspension of breath becomes longer and longer. You know, so this is, you again kind of find this in pranayamas, where you breathe, you know, and then you have ratios of breath, you know, long inhalations, long exhalations, and then suspension where you're not breathing at all. And I have done these when I was really practicing, experimenting with pranayama. You know, long, long suspensions, dangerously long. And so you get the idea that basically what happens is that, you know, from this approach, that basically what happens is the period of between inhalation and exhalation just becomes longer and longer and longer until you stop. Well, Alan's hypothesis is just the opposite. And this fits into what, you know, our experience here is that the period of breath, so let's just say the period of the wave remains the same. So you basically hit this period of 15 cycles per minute, 4 second cycle, and then you just stay there, the period for all the way through until the fourth jhana, when you stop breathing altogether. So the rhythm of the breath remains the same, but what happens is the volume, the amplitude of the wave, just becomes smaller and smaller and smaller. So you're breathing at the same rate, but that what you're just gupping atoms of air, you know, by the sipping an atom, you know, every 4 seconds. So interesting. And then in deep dreamless sleep, also apparently the research shows that in deep dreamless sleep you fall into the same rhythm of 15 cycles. So it's not long, slow, it's shallow, rapid. And then in dreaming, you know, it could be anything depending on what you're dreaming. But so just interesting, isn't it? So this is, I'll just share my own experience. What I have noticed when I shift from tactile sensations to knowing the breath directly. So we're going to be, you know, maintaining 80% of awareness and then 20% knowing tactile sensations. And then we're going to shift from basically the tactile primary consciousness to mental consciousness, knowing the breath, the rhythm of the breath directly, and forget tactile sensations. You know, so it's an easy enough thing to do. But what I've noticed is that the instant that I shift to knowing the breath, the rhythm of my breath changes. You know, and it's not as if it slows down really gradually or something like that. It's just like that. It can be fairly long and deep, and then all of a sudden, so just weird. But that's the, when you're, so one thing that I haven't mentioned is that one element of settling the speech in its natural state is also settling the breath in its natural state, meaning that you don't control the breath. So, you know, this approach to meditation is entirely different than the instructions that I got of equalizing the inhalation and exhalation for this number of breaths. You just give up all control of the breath and let the body breathe itself. And there are a couple of reasons for that, or benefits or outcomes of it. One is that if you are basically 5 heartbeats per breath, you know what the next breath is going to be. So you can almost stop paying attention because conceptually you know the breath. You got it. It's 5 heartbeats, inhalation, exhalation. And you can just become, you know the breath as a conceptual experience. But if you give up all control of the breath, it's living, dynamic, it changes, and you discover what is this breath. So it really keeps you engaged. And here's another reason for that, or outcome of that, giving up all control of the breath. If you were, you know, knew, if you just knew that the best breath was 5 heartbeats, would you ever discover this short, shallow breath? you would always know that the best breath is five heartbeats, inhalation and exhalation, equalized. So when you give up all control, you can discover, this is exactly what the Buddha was telling us to do. So have clear comprehension. And what you notice then is that the rhythm of your breath is directly correlated to what's going on, the agitation in your mind. And then what he's asking us to do is pay attention. The more turbulent your mind, is your breath longer or shorter, the rhythm? That's basically it. And then, just to let you know that Alan didn't make all this up, even though that it works really, really well. And of course, he wouldn't have made it up. He would have gotten a transmission, from the Lakeborn Vajra. But this is a common theme also in Dzogchen approach. And the best explication I've heard of that actually comes from Sogyal Rinpoche in his wonderful book, Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. And so this is what Sogyal Rinpoche has to say about breath meditation. So this is the Dzogchen approach to breath meditation that Sogyal Rinpoche is cluing us about. Don't concentrate too much on the breath. What is very important, the masters always advise, is not to fixate while practicing the concentration of calm abiding. That's why they recommend you place about 25% of your attention on mindfulness of breath. But then, as you will discover, mindfulness alone is not enough. While you are supposed to be watching the breath, after only 1 or 2 minutes, you can find yourself playing in a football game or starring in your own film. So another 25% should be devoted to a continuous and watchful awareness, introspection. One that oversees and checks whether you are still mindful of the breath. The remaining 50% of your attention is left abiding spaciously. So there you have it. It's very close. Because what Alan has asked us to do is 80% resting in stillness and spaciousness of awareness, and knowing that you're resting in stillness and spaciousness of awareness with continuous introspective awareness of that. So it's basically 80% versus 75%. And so you have here basically all of the functions. You're a small part of the smallest part of your awareness knows the breath, and then most of your awareness knows the stillness and spaciousness of the breath. And then that will prepare us very nicely for really beginning to get the difference between stillness and motion with this easier object of the breath. And then also you can have this experience of simultaneous stillness and motion, because you are simultaneously aware, stillness of awareness, rhythm of the breath, but it is an easy object to be aware of. The movement is not so compelling, not so alluring, not so distracting. So we will give that a shot. Let's take a break, and let's just come back at 2:30. We'll come back, and then we'll go directly into that meditation.